Okay, so today we start with the project description. That should only take like 10 minutes, depending on how many questions you have. So the project is to simulate quantum field fluctuations, the fluctuations of a quantum field. And the task is to choose some important or interesting states of a scalar quantum field theory, and then calculate the probability distribution for finding certain outcomes when measuring the field amplitude at a snapshot in time. And then once you have the probability distribution, draw from that probability distribution and plot something like a plot like this. This would be a typical visualization of the quantum fluctuations of a real scalar field in Minkowski space, where these are the contour lines, so lines of equal amplitude. And then discuss what you find. You can, if you wish, you could focus on Minkowski space alone, but it might be more interesting to actually go also all the way to expanding spacetimes and associated things there, or perhaps consider accelerated things in Minkowski space and so on. But here's how I would suggest to do that. I leave you a lot of freedom in how you do this, but I would like to outline what I think is the simplest way to get into this. And that is to do the quantization a little differently from how we did it at the beginning of the course. Namely, by choosing different boundary conditions. The physics is exactly the same, but slightly different boundary conditions. So consider the Klein-Gordon equation on Minkowski space. So I'm just getting you started here with the Minkowski space study. So the Klein-Gordon equation looks as always like this in Minkowski space in Cartesian coordinates. And we choose to consider the Klein-Gordon equation with an infrared cutoff. That is to say, we consider it as living in a box of size L. Now, earlier in the course, we did what most authors in the literature do, not all, but most, which is to consider periodic boundary conditions. And when you do periodic boundary conditions, it means you can do a Fourier series then, where you have the usual e to the power I xk, but the k are discrete. Now, what I'm suggesting to do here is instead to choose Dirichlet boundary conditions, meaning that we require the field to actually vanish at the boundary of this box. Instead of periodicity, we set the amplitude equal to zero. Makes no difference if the box is big enough, right? If L is like 100 billion light years, no way that it makes a difference. Now, these boundary conditions have a huge mathematical advantage for our purposes. Namely, when you have a function that lives on an interval, let's say from 0 to L, and it vanishes at the ends of the interval, then it can be expanded in a basis of sine waves only. We don't even need the cosine for that. Just the sine is already fine. You can look this up if you're not so fluent in Fourier theory. Look it up under Fourier sine transform. There's also a Fourier cosine transform, and there's also a Fourier series transform that involves both the sine and the cosine. They all achieve the same thing, though. Namely, they provide a basis of functions in the Hilbert space of square integrable functions on an interval. So here, consider the interval from 0 to L, and consider the space of square integrable functions on that interval, but also impose the Dirichlet boundary conditions. Technically speaking, the continuous square integrable functions that obey the Dirichlet boundary conditions form what is called a dense subset in the Hilbert space of square integrable functions in there. Then the theory of discrete Fourier sine transforms tells us that a basis in that Hilbert space of square integrable functions with these boundary conditions, a basis in that space is given by these basis functions, the bn of x, and they are square root of 2 over l, the size of the box, and then sine of n pi over l times x. And you see here that what you obtain is sine waves, which are, for the lowest n, they just go from 0 to l. And then you have one up, one down, and then you have 3 extrema, and then you have 4 extrema, etc. But all of these signs vanish at the boundaries, at 0 and at l. Then one can prove that these functions are orthonormal. So if you multiply two of those for some choice of n and some choice of m, then you find that the inner product between them, defined as the integral over the product of these functions over that interval, is the Kronecker delta of n and m. So they're normalized and they're orthogonal. And then Fourier sine expansion theory also tells us that we can write every square integrable function as we can expand any function in that Hilbert space in terms of these basis vectors. So the f of x is some square integrable function which vanishes at the boundary of the interval. Then we can write this function in this form, where these are the basis vectors and these are coefficients. And notice that n starts at 1 and goes to infinity. There's no negative n's needed here. And notice that the expansion functions are real valued, just like the original function. Previously in the course, at the beginning, when I showed you how this is usually done using the full Fourier transform, well, then we have here exponentials, complex exponentials. The coefficients are also complex. And that led to some trouble, because it meant that we get equations for harmonic oscillators who have complex amplitudes. That's not so nice. Then we showed that we can decompose them into real and imaginary parts and so on, but it was a bit messy. Here, using the Fourier sine transform, it's easier because the expansion functions, the basis vectors, are themselves real valued, and so are the coefficients then. Also, just to be completely correct here, you can expand not only functions that vanish at the boundary, also functions that don't vanish at the boundary can be expanded in this way. Now you may wonder, say, what? Each one of these signs is vanishing at the boundary. If you sum up infinitely many of those, they're all vanishing at the boundaries. And yet you can expand an arbitrary function this way. How can that be? Well, you need to know what that actually means. You see, what's implied here, and you can read that up if you study the Fourier sine theory, is a certain notion of convergence. Convergence with respect to a certain notion of distance. And the distance between two functions is the length of the difference between the two functions. Take a function minus the other function, and then you square that and integrate it up. That's how in quantum mechanics we also define the distance between two wave functions. Take the difference between the two functions and then square that up and integrate it, right? That's the notion of distance of Fourier theory, not just Fourier sine theory. That's the notion of distance of Fourier theory. It's also the notion of distance of quantum mechanics. And that notion of distance is obtained by taking an integral, right? We take a function, f1 of x, and then minus f2 of x, and then take the modulus squared of this and integrate that dx. And the point is that what these functions are doing at one point doesn't matter for the integral. So we have convergence here with respect to the L2 norm topology. Okay, so we can expand functions in this way. And these expansion coefficients can be calculated this way, just like in quantum mechanics, right? Do we have these basis functions? Okay, so here we take the basis functions and we multiply them with the function that we want to expand, integrate over, and that inner product gives us the basis coefficient. So with these two equations, you can go back and forth between two descriptions of the same function. Either you describe it as a function f of x, for every x you get an amplitude, or you describe it as a bunch of fn coefficients. If you know the fn coefficients, you can obtain the f of x. If you have the f of x, you can get the fn coefficients. You may wonder, again, how is it that a countable infinite number of these discrete numbers can capture the same information as an f of x, where we have uncountably much information in there, right? Because for every x, we get an amplitude. And the answer to that is that this is not really containing an uncountable amount of information. And the reason is that when we write down an f of x here, and in quantum mechanics in general, also for wave functions, we do not actually mean a map that maps every x into an amplitude. We mean the equivalence class of all those functions which map numbers into amplitudes which are not distinguishable under the L2 topology, because their difference differs only, for example, just at a finite set of points, the amplitude. This was just a quick review of what's going on in quantum mechanics, and here in quantum field theory we have the same thing going on. Which, if you think about it, is nice, because it means that quantum mechanics is under no illusion that the amplitude at a point really matters. Because in quantum mechanics, it's always the L2 norm topology which does not care about it. Unless if you have a Dirac delta there, which comes with its own issues. But if it's just regular functions, the amplitude never matters. The amplitude at one point alone never matters. Okay, so what I'm suggesting is that you use the Fourier sine transform, because it's so convenient that it just maps these functions into these sets of coefficients in a real way. You don't need any complex numbers for this. And use that three times for the x direction, for the y direction, and for the z direction. And what you then should obtain is the following. When you have a field phi of x and t, where x depends on x1, x2, x3, then what you obtain is instead a phi index n of t, where n is a triple index, where you have n1, n2, n3, corresponding to the three n's, one for the Fourier sine expansion of each of the orthogonal directions x, y, and z. So then you can take the equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation, the canonical commutation relations, and the hermeticity condition, and substitute this Fourier sine transformation, but three times, into this, so that you obtain these equations expressed equivalently in terms not of the f of x, but of the fn. So then what you obtain is the conditions that the fn have to obey, and the fn dot, right? Because we have phi of x and we have phi dot of x. And of course, these are the quantized ones now, right, with the hats. You can do that Fourier transform with or without the hats. And if you do a Fourier transform for functions that have hats on them, that is to say that they're operator valued, then how does that make sense? Think of it this way. If you do the Fourier transform of a function with a hat on it, it's operator valued, choose an orthonormal basis, a Hilbert basis, and then you can multiply from the right and from the left with one of those discrete basis vectors, and then you pick a matrix element. And what you see is that this equation for a function with hat is simply an equation for every matrix element individually. It's not mixing the matrix elements. Right? So every matrix element gets Fourier transformed or Fourier transformed back. All right, so what you obtain then when you plug that Fourier sine transform into these equations is at least that's what should come out, is analogs of these equations, and in particular an analog of that equation, which should be one ordinary harmonic oscillator for each n. Independent harmonic oscillator, because under the Fourier sine transform, just like under the regular Fourier transform, the second derivative becomes an n squared. But you need to be careful which n it is. You know, n1 squared, perhaps n1 squared plus n2 squared plus n3 squared, or something like this. Figure it out. Okay, so you obtain then one harmonic oscillator for each mode n, right? So each of these basis functions is what is called a mode. And its coefficient in front, this fn, has a dynamics, fn of t, or actually here we call it phi n of t, has a dynamics, and that dynamics is that of a harmonic oscillator and of a single quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator with the usual commutation relations. There's nothing funny about complex stuff that needs to be decomposed into real imaginary parts. It's just straightforward harmonic oscillators. Yeah, and then you can choose states for these harmonic oscillators. So you choose, for example, that they're all in the ground state, or all in the first excited state, or some of them in the first excited state, and so on. If you choose them all in the ground state, you're describing the vacuum. Once you have that, then by the usual quantum mechanical methods, you can calculate the wave function of each of these harmonic oscillators, so the probability distribution for the amplitude. So ordinarily, a quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator has a probability distribution, for example, for the ground state, which is a probability distribution over x, right? So you have that you have a harmonic oscillator, and then for the ground state, you would have a Gaussian probability distribution. So this would be psi of x modulus squared, and this is x for the ordinary harmonic oscillator. And for these harmonic oscillators, it's not x, it's the amplitude, it's the phi n value. If you measure the phi hat n, then you get a value phi n, and it's real in this case. And so this here is then the phi n modulus squared. And you may wonder, well, okay, but how do I know what phase this has? Well, no phases. This thing is real, right? It's real. It still has some phase, but that's just plus or minus one. And they're equally likely, because nothing breaks that symmetry. OK, so then you have the probability distribution. And then once you have for every phi n its probability distribution, and that probability distribution depends on, for every harmonic oscillator, it depends on what its omega is, which depends on the mass and the n squared. And it depends on whether the harmonic oscillator is in a ground state, then it's a Gaussian, or whether it's an excited state, then it's some Hamming function. Or it might be in some other state. You get to choose it. But once you have the probability distribution, then you draw numbers at random from that probability distribution. So a large amplitude should be unlikely, right? Large amplitude should be unlikely. Small amplitude should be likely. And you need to draw from that probability distribution. I give you a bit of time to figure out how to draw from a non-trivial probability distribution like this. Maybe later on I'll tell you, if you don't have any other method, how you can do it. I'll just tell you right away, all right? OK, so here's how you can do it. You draw a box around it. See, I'm saying this because most software that you might use doesn't allow you to draw from arbitrary probability distributions. They usually produce random numbers uniformly between 0 and 1. Often, they also have it built in that they draw according to a Gaussian distribution. But what if it's not a Gaussian distribution you want to work with? For example, you might have two particles present in this box. with a particular momentum. So that means that a certain harmonic oscillator is in its second excited state. So it's a Gaussian multiplied with a Hamming polynomial of degree 2. How do you draw from that? And the way you can do that is this. You take your probability distribution here, right? Okay, and then you cut it off at some point and you say, all right, it's just unlikely, because it's exponential decay here. It's very unlikely that you would get a number out here. So we just draw a box like this. And then you uniformly draw a number between here and here. That's easy. And uniformly draw a number between here and there. And that will describe a point somewhere in this rectangle, like this point. And next time maybe it's this point. And next time it's this point, and so on. And then whenever that point is above the probability distribution, you discard it and gamble again. And so you keep only those points uniformly chosen from here and there. You keep only those points which are under the probability distribution. Most of them will be here, right? And then fewer will be out there. In fact, they will be distributed according to the probability distribution, right? It's just by neglecting all those that happen to be outside that. It's inefficient, but really there is no really elegant way to do that other than quantum mechanics, right? In quantum mechanics, if you just draw from the probability distribution by measuring it, that's easy. Right? You just measure, and the gambling is done by nature itself. Whereas if we want to simulate that in high dimensions, almost all of the samples will be thrown away because they will be out there in high dimensions, right? It's very inefficient. So that's one of the things that quantum computers might be particularly good at. All right, so the point is once you arrived at the probability distributions for your modes, then you draw one number for each mode. And that gives you a bunch of phi n values, all real numbers, bunch of phi n values. And once you have these phi n values, you can plug them into an inverse Fourier sine series transform. Like this would be the phi n's in this case. And you get your phi of x. And that you can then plot with like a contour plot or maybe with colors indicating the amplitudes, stuff like that. And once you figure that out, then you can try out various things. So for example, in practice, you can only calculate so many phi n's. Can't work with infinitely many. And you can explore what difference it makes for your plots, whether you cut off early or cut off late. How does the character of the plots change? And what might be the physics of this? What effect on the statistics does it have when you give this species of scalar field, the species of particles, a mass? Try it out without a mass, mass equals zero. Try it out with a medium-sized mass, with a very large mass, and see how the statistics changes, and see if you can interpret what you find. For example, does the mass affect the infrared or the ultraviolet? In other words, does it affect the large-scale fluctuations more, or does it affect the short wavelength fluctuations more? Just observe what's going on and look at the equations and interpret what you see. Also, you can do this for quantum field theory in three-dimensional Minkowski space, I mean three space and one time dimension, and then plot what you get when you calculate the fluctuations, but plot just the xy plane, for example, just because it's hard to visualize in 3D. If you can visualize in 3D, great. But other than that, you just plot it in like 2D. But then compare that to what you would get if you calculated in 2D from the beginning. It actually makes a difference. It makes a difference whether you work with 3D and then take a 2D slice of it, or you actually take a theory that is truly two-dimensional. The pictures will look different, and you can consider why they might be different and what it is that makes a difference. And then consider excited states. Instead of the vacuum, put particles in there. Now, if you just take one of those harmonic oscillators and you excite it, then yes, you get one particle in there with a particular momentum indicated by that n value. I mean, n1, n2, n3. But that particle is spread out over the box entirely, right? Because it's a momentum eigenstate. And what you therefore should expect is that the picture doesn't change much because the particle is completely spread out. So what you may want to do is create a wave packet. Consider a kind of packet, and then Fourier series decompose that. And then from that, take inspiration of what modes you want to have excited so that you get a particle that's localized. So you have a linear combination of one particle states that correspond to a particle that's perhaps more localized. And that's already plenty if you want to consider all of these things. But then, of course, you can also use then also what we do later in the course, which is to do that for expanding spacetimes. Or you can also put an Androdovid detector into that field and see how that affects it. Whatever comes to mind. But this already is a big program if you want to do that. The project should not take more than 15 or 20 pages. In fact, make sure it's not more than 20 pages. And the structure should be title, abstract, introduction, motivation, theory, method, results, and a discussion of the results. And do that for, you know, the project you can decompose into sub-projects, like study of the dimensionality of it, study of what is the impact of mass, study of the impact of excitations of the vacuum state, and so on. And for each one, start with the motivation, what one might expect, what's the theory behind it, how are you going to implement it, and then discuss the numerical results and show pretty pictures and discuss what you see. Okay, I will post that also on our website. At the moment it's not up, but I will post that as well. Any questions about this? Okay, so we continue with the next lecture. Remember that we are going here a winding path, roughly following the winding path in the textbook by Vinitsky and Mokanov. On this side, we have the Hamiltonian column. This is all Hamiltonian formalism. All of this is the Lagrangian formalism. We like the Hamiltonian formalism because it allows us to work with states and operators and Hilbert spaces and study entanglement and all that sort of thing. And there's also much to be liked about the Lagrangian or action formalism. It's the same thing, Lagrangian and action formalism. And that's because in that formalism we can make the symmetry, especially the covariance, fully obvious. And we can enforce the covariance even when we introduce curvature. So this is as far as we got. We arrived here last time. And just to indicate on that map how we will proceed, we will spend some time here on this spot here where we went from special relativity to general relativity. So I will say something about general relativity and how we build it into quantum field theory in the Lagrangian formalism, or I should actually say into field theory, because we are not quantizing it on this here at that level just yet. So we do general relativity and the Klein-Gordon field here, and then we will do a short excursion right here, which is kind of the goalpost, right? This is general relativity and second quantized. That's a shortcut, and we will do that briefly. And then we will come back here, and then we will systematically go that way. We won't achieve all of this today. So we will do the Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian formalism. And there, at that point, we will find out what happened to this equation. Right? It used to be in Minkowski space that that's the case. That cannot be covariant. So what is covariant? And we will find out what is covariant there.
Quick question. We said that we like the Hamiltonian because we know how Hilbert spaces and states and separability, and we can talk about entanglement and things like that. I'm wondering, is there any intrinsically Lagrangian way of talking about entanglement?
Yes, there is, but it's more tedious. It's harder. You can translate in principle everything here, also there. And I've been involved in a like 10-year project that involved this. It can be very painful. But sometimes you have to do it because there's no way of keeping track of the covariance on this side. Yeah, I can tell a little bit about this today. You have a question too? No? Okay. All right. So what we had done so far is that we formulated the Klein-Gordon theory in special relativity using the Lagrangian formalism. And then we said, oh, we can also introduce curvature at this point. Once we have it in a fully covariant form, namely by introducing the metric, we can introduce curvature. And this is what we arrived at. It's the Klein-Gordon action. The Klein-Gordon action maps any field evolution, right? It's a phi of x and t. It maps any phi of x and t, any field evolution, into a real number, the so-called action. And how does it do it? Well, in this way. You take your field phi, the Klein-Gordon field, you differentiate it with respect to space and time. You know, the mu variable runs from 0 to 3. Remember that the comma means differentiate with respect to d by dx mu. Here, differentiate that with respect to d by dx nu. And here's the metric tensor, which is not necessarily the matrix with 1 and then minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. No. This formulation is good in arbitrary coordinate systems, even in spherical coordinates or whatever other coordinate system you may want to choose. This is always the same expression, but the G transforms non-trivially if you go from one coordinate system to another. Here we just take m squared phi squared, and v is a potential that contains our Klein-Gordon field and potentially other fields phi I. In reality, of course, there are not only Klein-Gordon fields such as the inflaton field and the Higgs field, but there are also all sorts of other fields, the electromagnetic field, and well, every particle species has its field. That would be in here. And then we notice that we also need the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric tensor G in order to make the whole thing scalar. At that point, we noticed, yes, we can change coordinate system in any way we want, and we get the same number for the same field. It's completely covariant and also what is called diffeomorphism invariant. It doesn't matter what diffeomorphic change of coordinates we perform, we get the same outcome of that calculation, same number s. Now, we can also step back and say, well, okay, what metric tensors g mu nu are we considering here? Which ones are allowed? Now, clearly, the one where g mu nu is a diagonal matrix with 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, and the diagonal is an allowed one, that would describe special relativity. But we will actually allow almost every symmetric two-tensor like this, including those which in no coordinate system take the form diagonal 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1 everywhere. So that is to say, including all those which describe curvature, but we do require one thing here. They cannot be completely arbitrary. They have to be such that at every point in the space-time manifold, we can choose a coordinate system. For every point, we can choose a coordinate system such that in that coordinate system, at that point, the metric takes this form eta mu nu, which is a diagonal matrix with 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. And this means that at every point of the space-time, the metric must be such that we can find a coordinate system in which, at that point, the metric takes the form as in special relativity. This requirement is the equivalence principle, because it says that the space-time is locally everywhere indistinguishable from Minkowski space. So in Minkowski space, we can find a coordinate system such that the metric is eta mu nu everywhere at once. But in arbitrary spacetimes, we can't have that. What we can have is that for every point, there exists a coordinate system that's adapted to that point's environment such that the metric takes this form. So that's the equivalence principle. Now, assuming that we have a metric of that form, then how can we identify, how can we check whether that metric describes Minkowski space or a space-time with curvature? Well, there is a method to do that. And this arises from the discipline of differential geometry. I have to quote a few results here. It's tedious to, not really tedious, but it takes a bit of time to actually derive these results. If you are interested in these and if you haven't taken my course last term, then I can point you to the relevant literature or my lecture notes about this. So briefly, if you want to know whether a metric tensor given as some function, you know, if somebody gives you g mu nu of x naught, x1, x2, x3, and then you're supposed to find out whether that function, this matrix-valued function, describes a curved space-time or just Minkowski space in funny coordinates. You see, this is, in general, you know, a bunch of 16 different functions. Well, not really 16 independent ones because it's symmetric. But how can you tell? And there is this method. You take the metric. Remember that with the upper indices, it's the inverse of the matrix with the lower indices. So you take the metric with the lower indices, differentiate it in the beta direction, differentiate in the alpha direction, in the new direction, etc. Calculate that combination. Multiply with that inverse matrix here, contract the twice occurring indices, and then you get what is called the Christoffel symbol functions. But that's just an intermediary step. Those you then plug into this expression to obtain what is called the Riemann curvature tensor. And the Riemann curvature tensor is crucial. It describes the curvature. And just to remind you, I'm hoping that you've all seen this before, but let me remind you how this works. The Riemann curvature tensor is something like the IH bar of quantum mechanics. You see, in quantum mechanics, we have that x and p don't commute. And the commutator is IH bar. And that's where quantum mechanics is built on. In general relativity, what you have is that moving in this direction and moving in that direction might not commute. So let's say you parallel transport something in this direction and then that direction, or you parallel transport in this direction and then that direction. So you go either this lower path or you go the upper path, and you parallel transport something along, then you see, if this is the vector to start with, if you travel this path, then maybe that's the vector that you arrive at. But if you parallel transport along this path, maybe that vector is what you arrive at. Or you parallel transport something around the rectangle, and when you arrive, the vector has been rotated by something, right? By some amount. And in general, you can start here, and then you parallel transport this way, and then you take a parallelogram, make it like this, and like that. So this could be your path of travel here. And let's say this is the vector that you parallel transported along this parallelogram. But when you arrive back here, then it has rotated by some amount. Right? The Riemann curvature tensor describes by how much this has rotated as a function of which vector you started out with and which parallelogram you walked. I mean, if you're wondering how that can happen, imagine you're standing on the North Pole. And you point straight ahead of you, and then you walk south. All right, so you walk towards the equator, and always parallel transporting your arm. And then let's say you arrive at the equator, and then you just step sideways along the equator, right? And parallel transporting your arm. And then you step backwards back to the North Pole, right? And then you see what happened? Now I'm pointing at an angle. And that's an important method to detect curvature, because it doesn't rely on the existence of a dimension outside the surface on which you're moving. So the Riemann curvature tensor accomplishes this. If you are taking a vector v on a parallelogram trip like this, where you have a vector eta and then a vector nu, and then you go back by eta and you go back by nu, then in general, the vector that you parallel transported has rotated a bit. And the Riemann curvature tensor tells you exactly by how much. Namely, the difference vector, v prime minus v, has components, A, and they can be calculated in this way. You take the Riemann curvature tensor, and then you contract these first two lower indices with the two vectors that describe the parallelogram. Right? So these, the eta and the nu, are the components of the two vectors that describe the parallelogram. And then you have used up the b and the c indices. You're left with an object that has an upper and a lower index. And that's a rotation matrix, or in relativity, it's a Lorentz transformation matrix, and then that will rotate that vector here. So that's the vector that's being rotated, and this is the difference vector there. You may wonder, well, how can I walk back that eta vector? The eta vector sits here, right? And the new vector sits there. Well, you have to parallel transport these vectors. And it's actually non-trivial that you arrive back where you started, because you have to not only parallel transport the v, you also have to parallel transport those vectors in order to keep track of which direction you went. And if you don't actually arrive back at the same point, then you have what is called torsion in your manifold. That's a mathematical possibility, but nature doesn't seem to use it. Anyway, we have no indication that spacetime has torsion. But let's keep in mind that it could have torsion. And this is how it would show up. OK, so the Riemann curvature tensor tells us about the non-triviality of parallel transport. You see, it's non-commutativity in the sense that instead of doing this round trip, you can also do this or that, right? And this means you first do eta and then do, what's the name of that? Nu. First eta, and then you walk in the direction of nu. Or you first walk in the direction of nu, then eta. And you don't get the same. This is a non-commutativity. I find it fascinating that quantum mechanics is built on non-commutativity, general relativity too, if you view it from this perspective. And in fact, you can prove that you can map this non-commutativity, in fact, into a non-commutativity of momentum operators. Momentum operators are generators of translation. And the non-commutativity of these momentum operators is in one-to-one correspondence to the presence of curvature. Which I think is cool because it means that you can take a curved space-time and map it into a non-commutative algebra. And non-commutative algebras, at least some of them, can be mapped into curved space-times. So, long story short, if the Riemann curvature tensor vanishes, then you don't have curvature. And if you have curvature, then the Riemann curvature tensor shows that by having at least some components that are not zero. Okay, so then what could be the dynamics of space-time? What are the equations of motion for the space-time curvature? And which are the degrees of freedom of curvature for which we have to find an equation of motion? Well, we know that the curvature is encoded in the metric already. If you know the metric tensor, you can calculate the Christoffel symbols from which you can then calculate the curvature tensor. So in principle, that's all we need, the G mu nu. It's just that the curvature tensor has this advantage that its vanishing indicates the vanishing of curvature. You can't request the metric tensor to vanish, right? Because even on flat space, it doesn't vanish. So it's much harder to read off anything from the metric tensor. Now let's remember that when you're given a G mu nu of x as a complicated looking matrix valued function of x and t, if it looks very non-trivial, it could be for two completely different reasons. Space-time could have no curvature whatsoever, but the metric could look very complicated, and that's just because of a very complicated choice of coordinates. Or alternatively, the choice of coordinates might be as simple as possible, but the space-time actually has curvature. That problem, namely that the metric tensor can look complicated for completely unrelated reasons, namely either choice of coordinates or the actual presence of curvature, that is something that plagues the field of quantum gravity a lot, because it would be so nice to be able to separate out from the metric what the diffeomorphism degrees of freedom are that only arise from changes of coordinates. And the Riemann curvature tensor itself is not scalar. So it too changes under changes of coordinate system. So if we want to define the equations of motion for gravity, then we need to build a scalar if we want to do it the Lagrangian way. And we are in the business of doing things in the Lagrangian way now. So we need a scalar. So therefore, we need a coordinate system independent function. How can we do that? Can we build a coordinate system independent function from G? From just G. Can we form a scalar from G? If we just take G mu nu, can we form a scalar with that? Can, right? We can just multiply it with the g with the upper indices and then contract the indices. That's a scalar. It is a scalar. But can we use it as an action for general relativity? Not really, because that scalar is 4. It's always a number 4, no matter what. Right? Because if you multiply this thing with the metric with the upper indices, it's the inverse matrix. So if you contract the first pair of indices, that just gives you a Kronecker delta with one upper, one lower index. And then you sum that up in 4 dimensions, that just gives you a 4. So that's not much of an equation of motion that you get if you make the scalar from that.
When trying to find equations of motions, at least quantumly or earlier even classical mechanics, they were looking at well observables. Is the metric here an observable in that sense?
Metric is kind of observable, yeah, because it tells you what the infinitesimal distances are. If you know small, if you have small coordinate distances, a delta x naught, delta x, delta x1, delta x2, delta x3, plug it here into the metric and you get what the invariant small invariant length is. So we can actually use the g mu, but it's 4. Nature seems to use it actually. And it gives us the cosmological constant. But that cannot be everything, right? So what we need is a non-trivial scalar. And for that, we need to start with something more complicated than the metric. And what better to use than the Riemann curvature tensor? Because we know that that's the thing that exactly describes the presence of curvature. But the Riemann curvature tensor has 4 indices, remember? And it needs to have 4 indices because with these 4 indices, you know, you contract 2 of them to describe the parallelogram that the eta and the nu vector are contracted with 2 indices to plug in the parallelogram that you travel. And then you are still left with 2 indices that describe the rotation matrix that, infinitesimal rotation matrix that tells us how the V is not preserved. So it must have 4 indices, but that's far from being a scalar. So then we can say, all right, let's contract it. So we multiply this with a metric g mu nu, or the same thing. We just set this index equal to that index, and we sum it over. And then we obtain another curvature tensor, the so-called Ricci tensor. At that point, you might wonder, that's pretty arbitrary, right? Why would we choose these 2 indices of all those? It has 4. It turns out you can choose other pairs of indices, and you would get exactly the same thing up to a minus sign. And the reason is that these indices have symmetries. And so it doesn't really matter. It's the only thing that you can get up to a minus sign. But we should keep in mind, and that's a curious feature, that this so-called Ricci tensor carries strictly less information about the manifold than the full Riemann curvature tensor. It's not in vain that it has so many indices. The Ricci tensor alone doesn't allow you to reconstruct what the Riemann curvature tensor is. In fact, if you count degrees of freedom, the Riemann curvature tensor has 20. The Ricci tensor, 10. So 10 are missing. And they are collected in another tensor that we don't need at the moment, another tensor called the Weil tensor, which also carries 10 degrees of freedom. OK, so that's the Ricci tensor.
Maybe it's a silly question, but maybe you know this. Like, it always puzzled me because you have the Riemann tensor, it has an aim. And then you take the trace, it has another name. It's like, so I wonder if the Ricci tensor has appeared in another context, like independent of the Riemann tensor, so it deserves like a name of its own.
Yes, that's right. It does. The Ricci tensor and the Weil tensor together carry the information of the Riemann curvature tensor. And the Ricci tensor has its own role, physically speaking, and the Weil tensor has its own role. The Riemann curvature tensor combines both of them, right? But the Ricci tensor and the Weil tensor separate out those 2 different things. And what they are is this. Ricci curvature exists only where there is energy and momentum. Wherever in the space-time, as we will see later, wherever in the space-time there is energy and matter, there can be Ricci curvature. But where there is no energy or matter, there cannot be any Ricci curvature. So for example, in empty space, the space might be curved, but it's not Ricci curvature. It can only be Weil curvature. So for example, gravitational waves a wild curvature. But the curvature inside a star, that's Ricci curvature. There can also be wild curvature on top of that. So basically, it's like the homogeneous and inhomogeneous solutions. Inhomogeneous solutions are with sources, and homogeneous ones are those without sources. So gravitational waves don't need sources, wild curvature, and the and Ricci curvature needs a source, and that's the energy momentum tensor.
But I mean, you always need to define the Ricci tensor as a trace of a Riemann tensor, and then you use an interpretation. Or there's a way of, I mean, suppose you never knew anything about the Riemann tensor, mm-hmm. and then you define an object, Riemann tensor, Ricci tensor, which is good for that. And then I discover, oh, this is the trace of this tensor. Is it possible to do something like that?
Yeah, yes. Yes, yes, because they behave differently under conformal transformations, the Ricci and the wild curvature tensor. I think this will come up later again.
Okay.
Let's discuss it when it comes up and we actually need it.
Okay,
it's good that you anticipate it already. Okay, so just keep in mind that, for example, for gravitational waves, the Ricci tensor is zero. So it's not indicating everything. But we're expecting to lose information along the way because we want a scalar, right? For the action principle, we want a scalar. And the scalar cannot know all the details of some tensorial structure, right? It's the same in classical mechanics. You have trajectories that are vectors of positions, vectors of momenta, and so on. But the action principle is just numbers, right? So you boil this down to the central symmetry principle. All right, so then what we take is the Ricci tensor and we contract it with the metric and then we obtain the Ricci scalar. And the Ricci scalar then is the simplest scalar that can be formed from the metric other than, you know, the four that we discussed before. So the next simplest tensor that can be built is the Ricci scalar. And then there are more scalars that can be built, but they must be built from powers of the Ricci tensor or even the Riemann curvature tensor and covariant derivatives of these tensors. And there is work out there on describing the curvature of a spacetime entirely in terms of scalars. You see, this one scalar is crucial because from that follows the Einstein equation. But if you want to be able to retrace exactly what the manifold is, then you need more than one scalar. And there are sets of scalar quantities which are, they say they have proven, I have not done the proofs myself, which carry the complete information of the space-time. I find it very cool because, you know, that's coordinate system independent information.
You mean you can reconstruct the metric tensor as a series mm-hmm. of those?
In principle, yeah.
In principle, you say there's no
problem. Maybe very hard. You see, you can always calculate the Riemann curvature tensor from the metric, but then from contractions of the Riemann curvature tensor to get back the metric must be hard. There's some sort of Taylor expansion going on that you can do in terms of higher covariant derivatives. Okay, so then we have a candidate. We have two candidates for the gravitational action, for the action of general relativity, namely the four, or let's just say a number, and the Ricci scalar, and then there are higher order terms. So in principle, what we should expect is this. The full action of all the particles that we know of plus gravity should be this total action here. It's the Klein-Gordon action, because we insist we want to describe a Klein-Gordon field, plus the action of all other fields, electromagnetism, electrons, and so on, plus the action for gravity. And the action for gravity is this one, where we have a starting number, right? Any number is a multiple of 4, so is covariant. I mean, it's really not just a number, it's a number times the square root of g. And then we have some number times the Ricci scalar, and then some number times the next simplest scalar you can build, and then some number times higher order scalars that you can build from the Riemann curvature tensor and its covariant derivatives. And ultimately, it's experiment that needs to decide which terms are there. It turns out that these higher order terms are, from the differential geometric perspective, as I explained in my course last term, those of you who have not taken it, I can point you to the right place there. From differential geometric perspective, one can argue that these terms should be much, much smaller than the other terms. We should expect them to be there, but they should be very small. And the experimental evidence is only that we have a C naught, the cosmological constant, and that we have a C1 in front of the Riemann, of the Ricci scalar. And of course, that's essentially the Newton constant. And here is what experiment indicates, namely that the Einstein action for gravity is minus 1 over 16 pi g, and then 2 times the cosmological constant, and then the Ricci scalar, times the square root of g. At this point, you might wonder, well, didn't we say that if we have a Klein-Gordon field alone, then it's going to have some boring evolution, it's just a free field. If we have other fields too, like the electromagnetic field and the electronic field and quarks and all those other species, then in principle they're also boring unless if they also interact with each other. And of course that's implied here that this action contains the free actions of all sorts of species and also the interactions between them, also including the interaction with the Klein-Gordon field. But gravity seems to be isolated here. So do we have that gravity is coupled to the other fields? Two answers to this. One is automatically, yes, always. And the reason is that in order for these two actions to be covariant, they must have metrics all over the place. They must have, for example, a square root of g term in front of the integration measure. All the derivatives must be covariant derivatives and so on. So the curvature is automatically coupling to all other fields in this way. But there's also yet another possibility, which is that among these higher order terms, there could also be terms that involve the curvature but also multiply a field. There could, for example, be a term r times phi, r times phi squared, stuff like that in principle could also be there. And that's actively being researched. We don't have positive evidence for these terms. I mentioned before that in principle these terms should be there. They should arise at least as counterterms from quantum field theoretic renormalization. We haven't covered renormalization, but I will eventually, at the end of the course, come back to that. Suffice it to say at this stage that, in principle, these higher order terms should be there, even though they should be highly suppressed. But you see, even if they are really, really small, there is a fundamental problem associated with these terms, which is that the classical theory makes no sense, at least not as a theory of the traditional kind. The classical theory of all the other dynamics that we know is a theory where you need to set initial conditions, two initial conditions at a point in time, and then the future evolution is determined. Right? Like you know the position of a ball and the initial velocity that you give it, and you can calculate the trajectory. But if you have these higher terms, then they have higher derivatives in them. And if they have higher time derivatives in them, it means you need to set more initial conditions. And in fact, you can have a situation where it's just not well-defined at all. There's no well-defined initial value problem.
When mentioning higher derivatives, I think at some point in previous lectures, we said that when trying to find a Hamiltonian of such a theory, it's pathological, it's unbounded. I think you said that.
There is a problem there, that's right. But we are not doing the Hamiltonians here, right? We are here doing just the Lagrangian formalism. But it's right, if you go back to the Hamiltonian formalism, you have to be careful, that's the Hamiltonian is bounded from below.
So that's my question. It seems to be completely well defined if you provide an initial condition for higher order derivatives, but if you somehow stumble upon a Hamiltonian that is or originates from something involving a third time third or higher derivative, it doesn't work.
There are multiple problems. There's the problem of the Hamiltonian not being bounded from below. That can happen. But it can also happen that there is just mathematically no initial value problem well defined. Now,
also I remember like David Lovelock, he proved that like in four dimensions, like the only theory for gravity is only the Einstein equation.
Yes, that's my remark down here. Right. So what I'm saying here is that Lovelock determined all the generalizations of all of these higher order terms, which are such that given the dimensionality of the space-time and given the terms that we have here, things still work out in such a way that you have a well-defined initial value problem where you only need to set two initial conditions. And Lovelock worked here in our Department of Applied Math, but many years ago.
Sorry, one last question.
Yeah.
Related to hyperbolicity, global hyperbolicity, because you
could, yes, that's right. Yeah, global hyperbolicity means that you have a hyperbolic problem with well-defined initial conditions. Okay, so experiment tells us that indeed these terms, if they're existing at all, are too small to be measured, at least at the moment, and the gravitational action looks like this. We should also perhaps keep in mind that it may not be so disastrous if there are higher order terms, even though they might spoil the initial value problem. And the reason is that that would be the classical theory that has this initial value problem. But we want to do the quantum theory of it, and it could well be that the quantum theory somehow works differently. Because remember that the classical theory is just the stationary phase approximation to the full quantum theory. It could be that the approximation fails and not the full theory. But something has to give anyway, right? Because gravity definitely is there. Okay, so we have the gravitational action now. And the total action then is the sum of the Klein-Gordon action, the gravitational action, and the action for all other fields and how they connect, how they interact. So the action principle then is to say that the total action's functional derivative with respect to all degrees of freedom is vanishing. If you remember, that's the classical approximation to the full quantum theory. The full quantum theory would have to do a path integral over all actions there. But in the classical theory, it's just the stationary phase, and the stationary phase approximation to the full Fourier transform of the quantum theory is to set ds by d, the fields, equal to zero. So this means that in the classical theory, the equations of motion are of three kinds. There is the functional derivative of the full action with respect to the Klein-Gordon action is equal to zero. The functional derivative of the full action with respect to the metric is equal to zero, and also the functional derivative with respect to all other fields is vanishing. So in particular, the phi fields, the little phi fields, were the fields that we call the other fields, electromagnetic and quarks, electrons, and so on. And the equations of motion that we get here, this is case A, the equations of motion that we get here are just the general relativistically covariant field equations for quarks, electrons, photons, and so on. And we will ignore them for now. The quantization, in principle, works like this. You take the action, read off what the Lagrangian is by dropping the time integral, and then do the Legendre transform to obtain the Hamiltonian. And then you know what the canonically conjugate fields are. You obtain that from the Legendre transform. And then you can impose the canonical commutation relations and do the usual quantization. Now, the next equation of motion is that where we functionally differentiate the total action with respect to the metric. That's case B. And in this case, the equation of motion that we obtain is the Einstein equation. So if you functionally differentiate this, the r and the square root of g, so that piece here, actually also including the lambda here. So if you functionally differentiate this with respect to the metric, then 2 pages of calculations later, you arrive at the Einstein equation. So the Einstein equation says that the Ricci tensor minus the metric times the Ricci scalar plus the cosmological constant is equal to 8 pi g. And here's the energy momentum tensor. And the origin of that equation, the left-hand side and the right-hand side have different origins. Remember that the Einstein equation is obtained by functionally differentiating the total action with respect to the metric. But the total action has the metric all over the place. You see, the total action is a Klein-Gordon action plus the action of the other fields plus the gravitational action. And the Klein-Gordon field has the metric in it. Right? And so do the actions of the other fields as well. And of course, the gravitational action also has the metric in it through the Ricci scalar. So when you functionally differentiate just the gravitational action with respect to g mu nu, you get the left-hand side. And when you functionally differentiate the Klein-Gordon and all the other fields' actions with respect to the metric, then you get the right-hand side. Actually, with a minus sign, but then you put it on the other side and then you get a plus sign there. So this expression here is actually the functional derivative of the other particle's action plus the Klein-Gordon action with respect to the metric. And that expression is called the energy momentum tensor. Wherever that is non-zero, we will have Ricci curvature. And how do we see that? Well, if this is non-zero, then the left-hand side should be non-zero, right? And the left-hand side has only Ricci curvature. By the way, there is a curious phenomenon that is the following. What we have is that r mu nu minus 1/2 g mu nu, and then we have the Ricci scalar, that's equal to 8 pi, well, let's just say it's a number, alpha, times t mu nu, right? And you might say, OK, just because this is non-zero doesn't really tell me, I mean, whether this is non-zero or zero doesn't really tell me whether that is non-zero or zero, because there is this combination here, right? There could be some cancellation. But it turns out that this equation is in one-to-one correspondence. It's true if and only if this is true, t mu nu minus 1/2 g mu nu, and then t, where t is t mu mu, the same way that r, you know, this is r mu nu, is equal to, and then some other number, beta, and then r mu nu, right? And that tells you that exactly if and only if t mu nu is non-zero, then r mu nu is non-zero, and vice versa. Now, that's very beautiful, I think, that this is also the Einstein equation. But weirdly, and maybe this is telling us something, this is only true in 4 dimensions. In our spacetime, it's true, right? 3 plus 1. But not in any other dimension. Maybe that symmetry between the energy momentum tensor and the curvature tensor is instrumental in determining that our spacetime has to have 3 plus 1 dimensions. All right, so that's the Einstein equation here. And then we can ask, well, OK, what we have here on the right, on the left-hand side is all clean, is always the same thing. But what we have on the right-hand side, that depends on what the matter content is. That depends on what fields we have. And each field contributes its own contribution to the energy momentum tensor. And we can ask, well, if we have a Klein-Gordon field, what is its contribution to the energy momentum tensor? And I worked it out for you here. So the energy momentum tensor for the Klein-Gordon field is given by this, where these are the derivatives in the y and the new directions, g mu, and here again derivatives. And this v is a potential that the Klein-Gordon field may or may not have. For example, it could be a phi to the fourth power potential that would show up in here. We will later see what kind of music this thing can make. I mean, how this plays into cosmology. One thing that we can already see at this point is that the contribution of a scalar field to the energy momentum tensor has one particular feature that is quite curious and will be super important later on. Namely, imagine there is actually a potential for the Klein-Gordon field. And for example, for the inflaton field, it is conjectured that it has a potential. Then, if the field, for whatever reason, quantum fluctuation or other reasons, if the field, for whatever reason, takes values such that the V is large, so large that it dominates over these contributions and those contributions, if that happens, then what do we have? Then we have that the energy momentum tensor is essentially g mu nu times v. Right? That's what that is. The energy momentum tensor is g mu nu times v, if the v is dominant in the energy momentum tensor. But what that means is that this contribution here enters the Einstein equation in exactly the same way that the cosmological constant does, where the V plays the role of a temporary cosmological constant. You see, in this equation, there's only one term that's proportional to the metric, and that's lambda g mu nu. That term is proportional to the metric. And if you've done general relativity before, which I very much hope, you know that if you have a cosmological constant, then it can make the universe expand, inflate exponentially fast. And that's what this V can do too, because its contribution to the energy momentum tensor is of the same kind. Depending on the sign, it can do that. And it will do that. And in particular, it looks, according to the current standard model of cosmology, it looks like this little thing here, that g mu nu V here, acts the same way as a cosmological constant. And the cosmological constant can make the universe expand exponentially. This might be the origin of our universe. Because imagine you have a universe in which this is going on. You have all these fields. You have a scalar field. Among other fields, you have a scalar field. And it has a potential. And then imagine, since this universe is very large, and maybe very old, that as a fluke, just as a random fluke of a quantum fluctuation, you have that the field is not actually varying much in a small patch. It is basically constant in time and constant in space, roughly, but at a value such that the V is very large, right? Just some patch, maybe just a few Planck lengths across, where the derivatives are not large. So these terms are not dominant. These are all derivative terms, right? And the potential, however, is large, comparative to this, right? It doesn't have to be absolutely large, just larger than these guys. And when that happens, anywhere in the universe, could happen in our universe now, right? Such a fluke. Then it means that locally, this acts like a cosmological constant, perhaps even a strong one. And that means that that little patch would very rapidly, depending on how large the fluctuation is, how large the V is, could very rapidly expand by like 10 to the 1,000 orders of magnitude, right? Because this gets completely out of hand. It's an exponential expansion. It might also just expand by like 70 orders of magnitude or something. But you can have a universe spawned out of a pre-existing universe, out of this simple mechanism here. Once you know that this does that, it makes a universe, it makes a space-time blow out exponentially, this could do it locally. So it's like mushrooming out a new universe from a pre-existing one. And I'm saying this at this level already because, you see, it's so basic. You don't need to go into a lot of assumptions and a lot of calculations to see this. It's so basic, which is why it's kind of a pressing thing, right? And it could actually be for this reason that universes spawn universes all the time. As long as you have a scalar field with a potential, that universe is not stable against the mushrooming out of daughter universes.
But what would that mean physically? Because the cosmological constant, sometimes we might interpret it as a negative energy density.
Yeah.
But I mean.
No. It's not negative energy density. It's negative pressure.
Yeah. Sorry, negative pressure. But I mean, what I mean is we have like a physical interpretation for this. For me, it seems like the potential is like the mathematical thing that we put. I mean, what would be like the physical interpretation of the potentials thing?
Oh, for example, for the Higgs field, which is a scalar field, we do assume this potential there, right? And you know what I mean? This W-shape type of potential. And we have a good model of that potential. And it's very important that it has this form because that leads to spontaneous symmetry breaking, which gives particles their mass. And it could actually be that the intraton particle is the Higgs particle. So it's not far-fetched that a field has a potential. Another way to look at it is simply that the field is self-interacting. Photons, for example, do not... No, we know self-interacting fields. For example, photons do not self-interact. Right? Two laser beams will just go straight through each other. But if you had gluon beams, they would not. They see each other. Right? Gluons have 3 and 4 vertices between them. Gluons are fields that self-interact. And the same is true for the W and Z bosons that carry the weak interaction. They are non-abelian fields, and they always have self-interaction. But the scalar field could also have a self-interaction.
So you were saying that the fact that a particular kind of particles see each other when they cross could be the reason why the universe is spending a lot of energy.
Yeah. Yes.
This sounds cool.
Yeah. Klein-Gordon field. Just because Klein-Gordon particles see each other could be the reason why universes born other universes. It's crazy, yes, if you put it this way. Yes.
But this term, I mean, at this level, we're still in a classical field theory. So.
Yeah.
So
classically, this would never happen. You need the quantum fluctuation to do this. Yeah. Okay. So in principle now, since we have the Einstein equation, why don't we just go ahead and quantize this thing? Well, nobody knows how to quantize this, really. First of all, where's the Hamiltonian of this? And then even if you do the Hamiltonian, you find that the time evolution is super weird. So nobody really knows how to do this. Also, the Einstein equation is very highly nonlinear in the metric, right? There's a metric here. And then the Riemann curvature tensor involves products of the metric. So it's a highly nonlinear differential equation. It's very different from the usual kind of equations of motion. And there are lots of attempts to solve it because people have tried to do the quantum theory of gravity for 100 years almost. Nothing satisfactory yet. Okay, so what we will do in this course is this. Initially, we will say, okay, gravity is too hard to quantize. We will keep gravity classical. So we will assume a background classical space-time, an expanding space-time, and we will study how a quantum field behaves on an expanding space-time. That's good as far as it goes, but at some point, we will have to introduce also the quantization of gravity to some extent. What we will quantize is not gravity overall, but small fluctuations, linearized perturbations around the expanding space-time need to be quantized in order to have a self-consistent theory. And it took like 20 years to figure out how that went. But that's known now, and it's at the heart of the predictions of inflationary cosmology. So remember, that's how it will go. We will first study quantum fields on a classical background space-time, and then we will also quantize linear perturbations of gravity, just because they can't really be properly distinguished from the fluctuations of a field. So it's necessary. Okay, and then case C, I mean, we already considered the equations of motion for all the other fields. We considered the equation of motion for gravity just now. And now case C, the equation of motion for the Klein-Gordon field. So here we have to take the total action functionally differentiated with respect to the Klein-Gordon field. And the Klein-Gordon field only occurs in the Klein-Gordon action. So this is the equation of motion. And this, if you remember, is the action of the Klein-Gordon field. I put in here, just for illustration, an example of what the potential might be. It could be a phi to the 4 potential. And then if we take this action, plug it into the usual Euler-Lagrange equation, remember we derived this one, then we can calculate what the Klein-Gordon equation is in curved space-time. And this is what we get. It looks a little messy, but we should expect that because we have phi occurring here, phi occurring there, there, and here. And the functional differentiations with respect to phi of the phi squared term is easy. With respect to the phi to the 4 term is easy. But look at that. We have to functionally differentiate with respect to the space and time derivatives of phi. Do you remember how we do that? We do an integration by parts first, so that the derivative then acts on everything else but the phi, so that we can then functionally differentiate with respect to that phi. But what do we get when we do that? You see, now something happens. If we do an integration by parts of this, so this is d by dx mu of phi, then this d by dx mu will act on everything else but that phi. So the d by dx mu will act on the metric, on this, and on that. All of that, right? And therefore, what we obtain when we calculate the equation of motion is this as the equation of motion of the Klein-Gordon field. And this little monster here is the D'Alembert operator. 1 over square root of g, and then d by dx mu, and then the metric again, and then square root of g again, and then the ordinary derivative of phi. That's the Klein-Gordon operator. Let's assume, just as an exercise, that the metric actually is eta mu nu. Well, if the metric is eta mu nu, then what? Then this square root of g is 1, this square root of g is 1. That's good. And this is an eta mu nu. And here we have d by dx mu. Well, that just becomes a d by x nu. And here of what is already a d by dx nu. So it's just the sum of the squared derivative. Right, it's the sum of the second derivatives, as it usually is. But in curved space-time, that's what it is. It's also the Klein-Gordon equation in Minkowski space if you write it in funny coordinates. Right? If you choose funny coordinates, that's how you can still calculate the Klein-Gordon equation then. So this differential operator here that acts on the phi, this one, is the D'Alembert operator on a curved space-time. Looks weird, but the origin is simply that we have to do the integration by parts, and then the derivative acts on everything but that phi, and that gives you these terms. So with the understanding that this operator is the D'Alembert operator, denoted by a box, we can write the Klein-Gordon equation in this innocent-looking form, knowing, though, that actually it's this thing. This is the D'Alembert operator in it. So now, I really have to speed up here. Okay, so this is where we are. We just discussed this in great detail. Now, down here, we have general relativistic formalism, second quantization. That's what we want, quantum field theory on curved space-time. And we can jump right into this using the path integral. And we will later do it, I think it's the very last lecture of the course, we will do this properly. Let me just give you a brief indication of how that works before we actually go this way. So a comment on the path integral. So here, PI stands for path integral, not Perimeter Institute. Okay, so a comment on that step here, this shortcut here, right there to in the action formalism second quantization. So we assume that the fixed space-time is chosen because we don't know, nobody knows how to properly path integrate over all metrics modulo the diffeomorphism group. So we just assume that we have a fixed space-time, so we are not really quantizing gravity here. And we are given the metric in some arbitrary coordinate system. Then, and we also neglect all the other fields. We only consider the Klein-Gordon field. And then for each field configuration, for each field evolution, so phi of x and t, we can calculate the associated action of that field evolution. Namely, it's this expression. We had that before. Again, for illustration, I put this as an example of a potential in there. And then, following Feynman, this action gives us a probability amplitude for finding that field evolution if we measured it. It's not realistic to think that we could measure a field evolution. Because after all, if we measured it at one point in time, we would completely upset how it evolves in the future. But in principle, as a guide for thinking about it, we can think that unmeasured, the probability amplitude for a particular field evolution is given by e to the power I over h bar times this. This is just like in quantum mechanics in the path integral formalism, where you also have a probability amplitude for every path that a particle can take while not being measured. So here, we have a probability amplitude for every field evolution that a field might take. A probability amplitude for every such field evolution that a field might take. And these are all field evolutions, not just the classical ones, but just any field evolution where the field just evolves and then does this just because, why not, and so on. All possible field evolutions. And then, knowing the probability amplitudes for all field evolutions, we can then calculate, for example, the correlation function for if the field amplitude at this event is this, and the field amplitude at that event is that, what's the expectation value of the product of these field amplitudes? Actually, there should be a time ordering operator in here. We may want to calculate that correlation function here. It turns out that in principle, if you know all the correlation functions of a quantum field, everything else can be calculated from it. And for Feynman, it's the starting point from the perspective of canonical quantization with Hilbert spaces and operators and Hamiltonians. It's a result. But Feynman jumps right into calculating that. So Feynman calculates this quantity not using vacuum states and fields with hats over them and so on. No. He says, I know the probability amplitude for all sorts of stuff to happen. I can just average over all possible things that can happen with these probability amplitudes as weights and then calculate what the expectation value of the product is. So he writes down the field and the field at these two events. And then here, the probability amplitudes that correspond to all possible field evolutions. And this is supposed to be a path integral, which is to say an integral where we sum over all possible field evolutions. So over all possible phi of x and t, where the function space is not really well defined. We can make it well defined by Vick rotation, but it's a different story. OK, so that would be the way to do it in the path integral approach. And you see, it's kind of elegant. And it's obviously covariant, because this is a scalar. and these are scalar fields. So clearly, this thing is scalar. Okay, but we want to know also about the vacuum and the Hilbert spaces and the observables and calculate stuff like entanglement and things like that. So here we are again. We just did a little excursion down to the second quantized path integral formalism of quantum field theory. Now we are back up here. And let's quickly do the Legendre transform back in order to find out what happened to this equation. Because once we know what the pi field is, then we can quantize. Because then we can impose the canonical commutation relation. OK, so remember that the Klein-Gordon action is this, firmly on this side here. It's the action, after all. And the equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation, is that. Now, from this action, we can read off what the Lagrangian is. It's what we get when we drop the time integral, right? Because we started with the Lagrangian, added the time integration, got the action. So now we undo that, and then we obtain the Lagrangian. The Lagrangian is this, exactly the same as that, just without the time integration. And you see, we're already breaking the explicit covariance right there. And now we do the Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian form. We're not changing the theory, right? We're just doing a transformation, which means we are preserving the covariance. If it was there earlier, it will be there later, because the equations of motion in the Hamiltonian side are going to be equivalent, as we proved before abstractly for all Legendre transforms, going to be equivalent to the equations of motion on the Lagrangian side. So even though we are losing at this point the obviousness of the covariance, it's still there, because what we do is equivalent. Under the Legendre transform being an invertible map. So we have the Lagrangian here. And then we can do the Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian form. So how do we do that? Well, we say, Legendre transform. Now, this is the variable, if you remember, that we need to Legendre transform into the momentum variable. This is the Legendre transform pair. So what we calculate is dl by d by dt of phi. That's the canonically conjugate momentum pi, right? Instead of that, what it actually is it's dl by d and then phi dot. That's the same in Minkowski space, but in the covariant form, in curved space-time, it's not. So we calculate that. So what is it then? Well, we take the Lagrangian here, and we functionally differentiate it with respect to the phi, 0. And now you see that we get four terms, actually. If we functionally differentiate with respect to that, then there is this, then we only pick up the term where mu is equal to 0, right? But then the nu is still running from 0 to 4, from 0 to 3. So what that means is dl by d phi, 0 is actually square root of g, that's here. And then we get the g 0 mu here, and then the phi mu. I mean, I functionally differentiate with respect to the phi, 0 here, but it's symmetric. And what that means is that this thing is actually the sum of four terms. Explicitly, we can write it like this. The canonically conjugate field to the phi field, the so-called pi field, is having a term that is square root of g, g naught naught, phi, 0. That's the term where we have mu equal to 0. And then we also have three other terms here, these ones. That would have been tough to guess that this is how it works. And remember that when we go from the phi dot variable to the pi variable, we need, for the purpose of the Legendre transform, to express the old variables in terms of the new variables too. So we need to be able to express phi dot in terms of pi. And we can do that. We can solve that equation for phi dot. And this is what we get. We get that phi dot, that is to say phi, 0, is equal to, and then we just divide that over here, and we get this expression, right? So now we can express the Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian then is the integral over all of the new variables, the pi, times all of the old variables. But the old variables need to be expressed in terms of this, right? The phi dot is all of this. And then minus the Lagrangian, but the Lagrange, in the Lagrangian contains phi dots, and they have to be expressed in terms of this again, so that it's only pi's. So that the Hamiltonian at the end only depends on phi and pi. There's not supposed to be any phi dot in this left. So you can see how the Hamiltonian actually blows up quite a bit. Oh, there we go. And I leave it to you as an exercise to do this. Actually calculate what the Hamiltonian is. That is to say, plug that in here. Plug that also in here, wherever a phi comma 0 occurs, and then simplify things to obtain the Hamiltonian. It doesn't look all that bad, after all. But no, you just have to plug that in here and then collect terms that are of the same form, and you find out what the Hamiltonian that is. And then, in this way, we obtain the Hamiltonian for Klein-Gordon field on curved spacetime, and we know what the pi is. Yeah, and at that point, well, we have now arrived here, right? We are back on the Hamiltonian side, but now with general relativity. And the next step is to second quantize that, putting hats on things, and then finding Hilbert space representations and so on. So it should be smooth sailing from here. All right. Any questions? Oh, and I should say that what we arrive at here is, of course, the same theory as what we just arrived with the peak view here, but it looks very different. What they have in common, the two theories, what proves that they are the same is the so-called Dyson-Schwinger equations. These are the differential equations for the correlators. Like, where is it? Yeah. That's a correlator. And you can have multi-field correlators, and they obey non-trivial differential equations of motion. And they are the same whether you calculate them from the path integral approach of Feynman or whether you calculate them from the Hamiltonian approach. So they're the same theory. But this is just much more instructive. We can do much more if we go to the Hamiltonian formalism. Okay, that's it for today then.